Welcome to CS Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 143 of CS Radio. I'm J. Michael DeAngelis.
I'm Natty Leach.
Natty, I return to you from the great state of Texas.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It was quite a journey. It was my first time on a plane post-pandemic, my first time amongst thralls of people in a tight space, but the Austin Film Festival, where I was, took everything very seriously. They took precautions, and everyone had to be vaccinated, so felt like, all right, I'm amongst as safe people as I can be. So.
And everyone behaved themselves, mostly you.
Well, let's not get into that. But yes, I am very grateful to Penn Career Services and to University Life, who have been kind enough to co-sponsor my visit to the Austin Film Festival. This was my fourth time attending in person and one virtual last year. And I really feel like it's been great because I'm getting some real insider information into the entertainment industry. And I'm always happy to come back and share it with you and our listening audience. So if you've got any questions about what was going on out in Texas and what's happening out in Hollywood, I'll do my best to answer them.
Yeah, that's good. It always seems like you have all sorts of fun things to share from across entertainment, not just one. Like, you have podcasting news sometimes.
For those who, if you haven't heard me talk about this before, the Austin Film Festival obviously is a international film festival first and foremost, but unlike any other film fest that I'm aware of, they have a conference attached to it, and is specifically a writers conference. And so it is for all entertainment writing. So there are screenplay tracks, television tracks, podcasting tracks. This year there was a video game track for the first time, as well as playwriting tracks. So yeah, lots of information. While focused from a writer's perspective, information from across the industry.
So what's hot on people's minds? What was the buzz at the conference this year?
Well, certainly streaming continues to just be on everyone's minds and the way that that has changed production models. It's a lot of pros and cons. Obviously, the pros, there are so much more content being produced now. There's, you know, all of the major networks, plus all the cable networks, plus all the streaming services. So there is content being produced all the time now. And with a streaming service, not just sort of between September and May, which is, you know, the television season. So things are happening all the time. On the other hand, orders are much slower or for less episodes. A streaming service probably going to order 6 to 8, maybe 12 or 13 on the outside. That means less jobs in the writer's room, because it's probably going to be a really small group. It may even be written by just one person. Whereas on a network show that's producing 22 episodes of SVU or NCIS or some other acronym show, I know you love an acronym, then that's got a room full of people because they're churning out so many of. So that is, you know, perhaps a con. And because of that, it's a little harder. What's interesting, and I've learned this over the past few years, I wish it was clearer to me when I was in college. There's a real structure to being a TV writer in Hollywood. There's like a work your way up the food chain way to do it, which is to start out as some sort of an assistant, either a PA or a writer's assistant or a producer's assistant, and just get into that writer's room and hopefully be in a room where your input is valued or asked for, and then maybe you get a chance to pitch an episode, and then maybe the next year you get a chance to co-write an episode, and then maybe you get moved up to staff writer, and then to consulting producer, all the way up to EP until you're off, you know, pitching your own shows. So, like, much more structured than I think we would think it is.
Well, yeah, a lot of entertainment is who you know, rather than there being a specific ladder. Except for writing, there is more of that structure where you can say.
There is. Listen, who you know is always going to be part of it. That doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be nepotism or you have to come at it from a place of a certain advantage. Obviously, those things happen. But just being at an event like I was at where I met people and someone was like, oh, that guy was nice, I'd work with him. Oh, you're interested in animation. I know a guy that's looking for an assistant. Let me put you in touch. That kind of real basic networking is still really important in Hollywood. You know, they talked also, we obviously talked some about the changes that the pandemic has had on the industry. The good news for writers, and I mentioned this in last year's episode after the virtual conference, everybody kept writing. Production slowed, but what can we do? We can keep buying shows and we can keep writing and we can write over Zoom. So a lot of people left LA and met a lot of people that had moved either back to or to Texas. Met a couple of people from Phoenix that just, you know, were looking for some fresh air, metaphorically and literally, and were able to stay writing because it was all happening over Zoom. They did feel that in the next 6 months for TV writers, it's probably going back to in the room, but maybe not. You know, there may be some producers that are just like, I like this better on Zoom, but there may be others who feel like there's a real advantage to being in the room, particularly on sitcoms, they mentioned, because so much of a sitcom is sort of group generated. I heard one guy say that he was briefly invited into the Big Bang Theory writer's room, and he felt that like their way of writing was essentially to be in the room and improv an episode. So like you would say some Sheldon lines and I would say some Penny lines. Bazinga. Right. And just,
I've never seen the show.
You know, people would just throw out the scenario and then you would go, oh, and Sheldon would say this, and then you go, oh, and then they would say this, you know.
Yeah.
So there is an advantage to having that sort of energy in a comedy room. So they did feel that TV was probably moving back into the quote-unquote office within the next season.
So these people have like things stockpiled now like they didn't before of things that are getting ready to be produced that weren't able to be. So are we going to see a influx of production in the coming year or so?
TBD. Yes. But of course, famously, not everything that gets developed, it gets produced, right?
Yes.
So there may have just been some churning of the wheels because we could churn the wheels. But other things may absolutely be going into production. I think, you know, I don't know about you. I have not lacked for entertainment over the pandemic. They did manage fairly quickly to get back on sets and things. It's definitely different. It's more expensive with all protocols and testings. But things do seem to be in production. It's been really good for animation because animators, particularly now that animation is done on a computer, even if it's hand drawn, nobody's doing ink and pencil anymore. It's still done on a tablet. Everybody can work on that from home. So animation has had a small explosion. So that those things are going to see much more animation in the next year, probably.
Is it? It seems like to me, as a viewer, there are more limited series type
yes.
shows. Is that a thing?
So definitely a thing. And this sort of goes back to what I was talking about with the streaming services and offering smaller orders. They probably will gravitate towards something that is more limited or possibly in an ideal scenario is limited, but could be more, you know, like, okay, that tells a complete story, but we could come back again next year and tell a similar story or pick up other threads.
Yeah, I kind of appreciate not always being held on a cliffhanger. Like,
well, I think certainly tastes have changed and how we watch things are changed. I know my parents, right? And you think, you know, my parents are in their 70s, and these are people who you may think watch things more traditionally. No.
Blaze through it.
They don't want to watch it until they know it's over. And so that they can watch the whole story.
Yeah.
They can't wait week to week anymore. They don't like being left hanging. They like knowing that it's going somewhere.
It almost seems like there's more cliffhangers episode to episode than there used to be.
Well, so I definitely talked about this previously. I don't know that it came up too much this year, but I remember it being in several sessions in years past where they talked about the sort of traditional 3 or 5 act structure of a script has changed slightly when it's a streaming show because streaming wants you to stay on for the next one. So cliffhangers are much bigger. And sometimes you and I have talked about this just in our, you know, talking about what we watch, that an episode seems to reach its conclusion, but there's still 10 minutes left in the episode because they're already getting you into the next one.
Traditionally, that would have been the beginning of the next episode.
Yeah, I felt like the Netflix Marvel shows did this a lot. Where I was like, that story is over. Why is there still 15 minutes in this episode? Oh, because we're all basically already in the next episode.
Yep. Squid Games got me just last night. And on like as much of a literal cliffhanger as you could leave it. And of course, I started the next episode and kept watching.
Right. So, you know, those are things you have to think about when you are writing for TV now. And if you have to know what your platform is. Certainly, it was interesting to hear that as a writer, an up-and-coming writer, you should have as many different scripts in your arsenal as possible, both spec scripts for existing shows and your own original thing. So you should have a three-camera comedy, you should have one-camera comedy, you should have a procedural, you should have a science fiction show. I mean, if those are things you're interested in working on, you should have one of everything so that you can show people. Because let's say you wanted to get a job on, let's say, The Good Place, right? You're not going to hand Michael Schur NCIS scripts to get a job on The Good Place, right? So if you want to write on The Simpsons, you're not going to hand a Law & Order script in or a Star Trek script. Maybe you'd hand in a Family Guy script. Maybe you'd hand in a Bob's Burgers script. So maybe you'd hand in a Simpsons script. You know, so just to see that you can write in those different genres.
So be prepared.
Be prepared. The other thing, this was the first time I was hearing this, but it goes back to exactly what we were just talking about. If you get the opportunity to pitch your own show, they're going to ask you to lay out an entire season, and they're probably going to ask you for a quick snapshot of the whole series, including where does it end. They want to know that you have an end in mind so that they don't buy into something that they don't know where it's going.
Game of Thrones. It comes back.
I think the example most people use is Lost.
Yes. Going into what you said, how people's viewership changed, I binge-watched Lost in college, went through basically the whole thing within a week, and I didn't feel as disappointed, I was ready to be disappointed. Everyone told me how
I also like the ending of Lost. I think it works completely on its own terms. I think if you ask Damon Lindelof today, they did not know that was going to be the end, and if they had settled on it earlier, they would have done some certain things differently. That was a show I certainly was watching every week, and I think that the experience does change it because, you know, I'd come in here and there'd be people. It was like all we would talk about. If, you know, Lost was on Wednesdays, I think. You come in on a Thursday. Probably everything before lunch was just talking about Lost. And what did this mean? And what did that mean? And oh, my God.
What's in the hatch?
Well, yeah. And why did Locke do that? And oh, my God, that flash forward was a game changer. And this changes everything we thought about last week. And then you ruminated on that for a week. And then you got the next bit. And then after 7 years, that builds up a lot of expectation.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's really hard to stick the landing at that point. And I think probably if that show was around today, they would approach it differently. Again, this is not to knock Lost. I still love Lost. I
love the whole thing, start to finish.
I still think the ending is great.
I thought it was a good send-off to the characters. I would
love to work for Damon Lindelof or Carlton Cuse. If you're listening, I'm available.
Did it come up? One thing I wonder about is that time in between shows, especially as shows are shorter.
Yeah.
How does that work for those who are kind of moving from project to project and seeking new things?
Yeah, that did come up. I went to a panel called Navigating the Writer's Room about relatively young writers who journeyed from assistant to now. Somebody was just about to launch their own show. Another guy is an executive producer on Bob's Burgers now. Actually, I thought of you, Natty. He writes all of the South Park video game content.
Oh, great.
So he wrote the Fractured But Whole and all of that stuff. He's the head of South Park digital content.
Nice. And those have been great. I mean, I haven't played all of them, but the ones that I've played have been very, like, this is just a South Park movie in video game form.
So, and he's moved from that now to being an executive producer on Bob. So, you know, really interesting careers. Yes, basically the advice they gave was you have to make it known because people are still in the sense, oh, Natty writes for South Park, so he's busy. Well, if South Park's only 8 episodes now, right, you're not busy all year. And it was actually a really great example because Jamil was his name. He's like, Bob's Burgers basically doesn't take a break. They produce a 22 or 24 episode season, and because animation takes so long mm-hmm. to get produced, you know, they're already writing next season, you know, now that we're going to see a year from now, because it takes 6 to 8 months to get the animation back. So he's like, we don't really get a break. So I'm now booked. But the folks that were on streaming shows, I think one person might have been on a Showtime show. But again, it's going to be maybe 12 episodes instead of 24. She just said, when I'm getting close to wrapping that up, I call my manager and I call my agent and I say, let it be known, I will be done on March the 1st and I will be looking for work on March the 2nd and I am ready to go into anybody's rooms and we're not coming back to this until, you know, August or next January or whenever. So, you know, she said, you do have to do a little bit more advocating for yourself than you would have had to in the past when it was much more on a predictable cycle mm-hmm. where everybody is looking to fill showrunner rooms starting in the summer. Now they happen when they happen, particularly because the streaming services like Netflix have to premiere shows like monthly.
Is there some strategy to the projects that you choose as you go through that? If you have one of those more, you know, there's another season lined up, do you choose a smaller limited run series, or are you just kind of set and you know I'm going to be doing this forever, so even if there's some downtime for the writing, you're just set waiting for that next season to get back in the writing room?
I think it probably depends on the project. You know, if you're not writing, you're not getting paid.
Yeah.
Right? So even if you know you're going back to something, if you know what that break is, if you need the money, then you're going to just try and get on another project or try and get something else sold, you know, maybe something original sold. I've heard it said before. I heard it said actually by one of the writers of Lost was at the conference this year, and he said, I've made a very good living selling things that you'll never see. And I heard Mark, was one of my favorite writers a couple of years ago, said basically being a screenwriter for movies that never get made has subsidized his second career as a novelist, because he doesn't make a ton as a novelist, but sure, I'll write this big budget franchise movie for a gajillion dollars, and then it goes on somebody's desk. And I don't really care if it ever gets made or not.
And people just buy the rights to it, right? And then they think, oh, we'll look to the future of whether we're going to actually
produce. They, you know, it may be something, they have the rights to a book, and they'll give it to you. I heard that said many times, that you might go in with your original idea, and you're going to pitch it, and they're going to be like, great, we love it. We actually own something very similar to that. So here's this book, go away and turn that into a movie. Because there is a tendency, shall we say, to want to go with established IPs already rather than take a gamble on something new. So anytime that you can get on the ground floor of an IP, it's encouraged, and you have to be able to position your original ideas in ways that you can say, it's just like Ant-Man, but not.
This, yeah.
Right. Yep. That is a favorite pitching exercise that my writing partners and I like to play, where we just do, it's this, but it's this. So my favorite one I've ever done, and I went on this whole, like, I wish I had been in a room because I probably would have sold it. It's Phantom of the Opera, but with baseball. And then I like did the whole movie. Oh, he's the organ.
Yeah, the organ, yeah.
He's the organist in the stadium. He gets hit by a foul ball. He's all disfigured.
It.
I did the whole thing. So if anyone's listening, that idea is available. Please contact my agent, Brian Sherman at Apex Artists.
Hey, I pitched you an idea in that format too. I'm not going to share the idea because I'm scared.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. I'm going to buy that idea from you, and you're going to make a handsome living, a sale that I make, and then it never gets made.
I'm excited. So you also mentioned video games were more prominent this year. Was that like the writing for AAA titles, or was it for all these different video games that are being made into their own shows like Castlevania and things like that?
No. So as you know, because I texted you immediately, I did attend one panel about the Dota anime. Natty, if you don't know, is a huge Dota player.
Play every night.
And so I was interested because I sort of I'm working on my first animated writing. I've never written for animation before, so I went to a panel about writing for animation. But the video game track was about writing for AAA video games. I wasn't able to attend that, but my friends John and Paige went to that and filled me in. Very interestingly, everybody said it pays to have a game development background, that they want people that know not only how to write stories, but people who literally know how to write video games.
Yeah. Well, that's what it's always been, right, for that industry, is that there usually wasn't someone else coming in and writing. It was usually them getting together and doing it all themselves.
Right.
Interesting, though.
Yeah. So if I were to... Well, it's interesting. I did, many years ago, I did get approached to write a video game by an indie producer. And luckily, Pete and I are enough gamers that we sort of knew how to approach it. And I think we got through all the initial meetings okay. It unfortunately never went anywhere, but I was like pretty excited by what we had planned. But it definitely required us to think like gamers. And I would imagine if I had some actual programming, Pete has a little bit of programming knowledge, just enough to be dangerous, I think. They did, and I wish, maybe you might actually know. If I can't remember it in this conversation, I will make sure I look it up and include it in the show notes. There is a program to write branching narratives. I had heard of it, but that's...
I think I might have heard of it too, but I don't remember it.
We'll put it in the show notes. They said if you at least have experience with that, that's a really good starting place. Because, you know, Natty, you know, as a gamer, a lot of these AAA titles require you to make narrative decisions that then alter the gameplay. Are you going to side with the light side or the dark side? You know, I spoke to you at length. I played this game, the Outer Worlds, yep. And I thought that was the most narratively rich game I've ever played.
That's the best example, especially of choosing things and having things actually end up different, that I've played in a long time in that game. A lot of times there's the illusion of you're making a choice,
right.
But at the end it doesn't matter.
No, I completely agree. That is how I felt for a long time about video games. Like, well, it feels like I'm making a choice, but in the end, I'm going to fight this guy. But the thing that really got my attention was my friend and I were playing at the same time. And I said, oh, so blah, blah, blah. And he's like, wait, what? I was like, you know, me and the priest. And he's like, the priest? I was like, yeah, he's my companion. He's like, oh, I fought and killed that guy. I was like, so that's really shocking that this guy can either be your enemy and you can kill him, or he can be your, like, number two. So I was like, oh, there are decisions to be made here. So that sort of thinking for me as a writer is both exciting and dangerous, because I can go down the rabbit hole, right? I can go down the rabbit hole of all the different possibilities. And I have to think, you know, my friends, you know, as we've done on this podcast, I occasionally do Dungeons & Dragons and DM, and I always compare myself ill-favorably to my friend Chris, who I play in his game when he DMs. And I just feel like that guy has every contingency already planned for. He's like, well, you know, Natty might marry this elf, so here's all of these contingencies, or he might fight this elf, or he might, you know, like, I'm always shocked when we do something that I think is going to be unexpected, and he's like, ah, you made that decision. So, like, Chris could definitely write for a game like that, whereas I think I would maybe not always see all of the forest for the trees.
It's interesting, because usually AAA titles tend to be more cinematic in nature.
Yeah.
They have the big budget. They go for big cutscenes, like flashy graphics and things like that. So the things you think of, like Uncharted, which is going to be a movie soon, Last of Us, like those all are very narrative driven, almost like a cinematic experience. Whereas you see indie games are really the places where you see the most creative things with storytelling.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
The game, I played a game just a couple days ago. I just bought it randomly. It looked interesting to me. It was kind of themed appropriately to the season of looking a little bit spooky, and I played it. It's called Inscription. Had one of the best stories I've played in a very long time. I don't even want to talk about it because there's so many interesting twists and turns, and they pair it so well with the gameplay. Whereas a lot of times in those AAA titles, it seems like the writing is kind of just, here's the story. In between the story, there's a fight. And then you go on to the next part of the story. Whereas this game, there are so many things that were really creative with how you use the gameplay to tell that story, which I thought was interesting. And speaks to what you were saying earlier about having a game design background can help you a lot in the writer's room for writing for video games.
So I want to make sure I touch on an important point that I thought was slightly revelatory to me. I went to a panel that was a group of managers, and somebody said, you know, how do I get a manager, right? Like, you are discouraged from just sending your stuff out there cold. And both of the managers said, we disagree. That might be true at an agency. That might be true at a studio where they don't want to read your things in fear. But for a manager, both of them said, we'll read just about anything that gets sent to us. Mm. And they were like, you can just go on our website and find the person to send it to, right? You should not be afraid to do that. And if we say no thanks, you should feel free to ask us why. And then you should feel free to say, all right, I'm going to take that advice and I'd like to come back to you in a couple of months. Well, you know, as long as you're not an asshole about it, we're always happy to do that, right? To, you know, don't be afraid to go out there and make contacts. And they also talked about something that I think is definitely a way that I have thought about myself in the podcasting world, which is you're part of a class, right? Class in air quotes, that you kind of come up with the same amount, the same group of people. So whether you went to film school and you're all kind of coming out into the world at the same time, or you all have just moved to LA or whatever, you're with a group of people that are at the same level, and then you're all going to grow together, right? So you make those connections early. So find someone who wants to become a manager, right? Maybe someone who's an assistant at a management company. That means they've got a couple of connections, that they've learned a few things, right? Because those people all want to move up themselves. So they're sitting there and they're looking for the script that their boss goes, I don't think so, but they're real excited about.
Yeah.
So it was a very funny moment. There was a young lady right in front of me who said she was an assistant in a management firm and she wanted to become a manager. And she said, you know, do you have any advice for me? And he was like, yeah, get the business card of every writer in this room. And then he's like, you can hear 100 business cards being pulled out. And they're like, yeah, we're going to have to get her an escort out of this room later. But it's true. I think it's absolutely true. I can imagine that there were connections made at the conference this year that are going to blossom into really true professional relationships. I hope some of them involve me. Because the other thing, and I've said this every time I come back from this conference, the number one thing that you hear over and over again is don't be a jerk. People like working with nice people. Find the people you want to work with on the things you want to work with, and you can make it happen. Because it's such an intensive business, just time-wise. If you're going to do a TV show, you're looking at least a year of your life, but probably multiple years. Long hours together in a writer's room. If you're working on a movie, even if they drop you as the writer once it goes into production, you're probably writing and rewriting that thing with the producers for a year or 2 years. So are you somebody that somebody wants to spend their amount of time with? And, you know, just be nice. Like, and every single person that I've met, these are people whose names you see on your TV all the time, people you would recognize, are each the humblest, nicest people. I would be thrilled to be in a room with any of them, right? And I find that really, really reassuring. We did get to hear from Michael Schur, who is the creator of Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and The Good Place, worked on The Office for a long time, worked on Saturday Night Live for a long time. And, you know, I think you can feel his spirit imbued in the shows that he created about being friends and being good people and, like, working together for a common cause, even if that cause is just making people laugh, right? And I'd like, isn't that what everybody wants at their job at the end of the day? Like, so why should Hollywood be any different?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's great advice for any industry, but especially in one that is so highly collaborative and project-driven. There's so much less of that individual busy work and so much more of the bouncing ideas back and forth and really, like, getting to know people and know what to expect from someone when you send an idea out.
Yeah.
Thinking, okay, how are they going to take this and how are they going to move it to that next level beyond where I'm at right now.
Yeah. So for young writers at Penn, or not so young writers, have your stuff, be ready, send it out, send your original scripts out, find a manager, maybe find an agent. Manager might come first, I think, nowadays, and network. And, you know, if you have any advantage, it is the power of the Penn network. But, you know, even if you're not a Penn student and you're listening to this podcast, you have some network. You have your own collegiate network, or you just have your personal network. You know, just leverage it, you know, make friends with people, be a nice person, meet other people. I'm a pretty big tweeter, right? But my friend Paige, she came with us to the conference. She lives out in LA, and she met all of these people that she's been tweeting with. And so she like met these people for the first time, but she already knew them because there's this whole like writer's enclave on Twitter that people are latching onto those hashtags and joining these groups. And, you know, she just leveraged that into real connections. And it's amazing what you can do.
Yeah. Some people get in their own way, right? So often the advice we give is be a normal person.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to what we're talking about right now, is you being nice and being excited and generous and humble are all things that everyone wants to work with. And a lot of times I think, especially when you're projecting ahead for where you want to be, you think there's a certain way you need to act or a certain thing you need to say or do to be able to get ahead in some sort of way. But a lot of times it's a lot more simple than that. And it's just making friends with your coworkers or your peers and keeping those connections alive as you think about what you want to do for your next opportunity.
100%. I want to touch on two other things really quickly. I know we're approaching the end of our show. The entertainment industry as a whole does not know what to make of TikTok.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess TikTok is fringe entertainment in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
Micro entertainment.
But basically, these new media stars, but particularly TikTok, is so loose and structureless, and it's basically built around personality.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas if you have a YouTube show, that might maybe have some structure to it. Somebody asked, I have a script, I have a TikTok star attached to it. Does that hold any weight? And the producer panel all went, yeah, we don't know. We're trying to figure that out right now. You know, Netflix put out a movie with Addison Rae, who's a big TikTok star.
Wasn't Dylan Maxwell in, what's that show called? Come on, the vandalism show with...
Oh, I didn't do the dicks.
Yes, I wanted to say that.
American Vandal.
Wasn't he a social media star in some sort of way too before?
Yes, I think that's right, yeah.
And I was looking at, I think it was UTA, one of the talent agencies' websites. They have a whole section
those people are big money, and they all have managers and agents, but mostly for content sponsorship. So that crossover into reality TV, you know, that TikTok family, the D'Amelios, are essentially lining up to be the next Kardashian family, right? Mm-hmm. They've got a Hulu show about their lives. But as far as putting those types of stars into a movie or into a scripted thing, is that a thing yet? We don't know. They were very honest. They were like, could be the biggest thing, but we just don't know yet.
It's got to be close. I mean, there are people who have kind of forged away already. Bo Burnham was kind of like that, right?
So there are absolutely people. So, but like Bo Burnham, like he's a writer,
yeah,
right? Like he has things he wants to say. If you're, and again, I am not saying this in any way to disparage what these people do, because they're very successful. But if your whole presence is just being a bubbly teenager that dances or does makeup tips or just goes to exotic locations, is that going to translate into I can deliver some lines, right? It may not. Like, we've seen that across time. You know, in the 90s, every stand-up comic was given a sitcom. And most of them couldn't do it. It's not the same art form, right? So it's probably going to be person to person. But if you were to put a TikTok star into a movie and it put butts into the seats and it made a gajillion dollars, then that's enough.
Yeah, that's success enough, even if they don't act very well.
But we haven't seen that yet. Most reality stars haven't translated to the big screen. You know, like Kim Kardashian made a movie, Paris Hilton made a movie. Like, yeah. These are not movies that anybody went to see. From Justin to Kelly is the punchline of I'm sorry if that's your favorite movie, Natty.
I have a personal connection to Justin.
Well, we all love Justin here in Philly. I don't think Justin wants to see that movie.
What was the other one? You see it through music a lot. There's all these people who go from reality or social media to music you see as an overlap.
Yeah. Again, I think it's a closer one-to-one because they might be doing music on their social and then you can go and just do that on a bigger scale. But like you can't – again, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the next thing. Maybe doing TikTok dances for 90 minutes on the big screen.
Yeah.
Like – we know they can do that. Does anyone want to see that?
I was thinking about, I don't know his story, but my partner Emily and I used to watch Catfish every now and then.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
And one of the stories was about a guy named Todrick. And all of a sudden we started seeing Todrick other places. He was on Catfish, one of his songs was in Sex Education, that show on Netflix we watched. One of his songs was playing and the main character was singing and dancing that song. We're like, we saw him when he was on this random reality show.
Are you sure you're not being catfished?
Maybe we are. Yeah. I had something else I forgot. Cut that.
So, you know, I want to thank Career Services. I want to thank Penn for, you know, co-sponsoring me on my sojourn out to Austin Film Festival. I want to thank the people at Austin Film Festival. That conference is so unique. I was so grateful to be back there in person this year. I was so, you know, energized by being amongst writers and being amongst really nice people and eating some really good tacos. Natty is sick of me hearing him talking about these tacos.
I've seen photos like they're your own children.
They might as well be. God, they were so good. Velvet Taco, this is my shout out to you. You got me through 5 days in Austin. You got me through... Literally, my flight got canceled, and after like 30 minutes of panic, I was like, upshot, I can have at least two more tacos. And I did.
Did you make your way through the whole menu?
Oh, no, there were too many to make my whole way through.
So there's an excuse for next year.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I do hope I get to go back next year. I hope I get to come back and share information with you again next year. I have a lot more to say. You know, I learned a lot. I met so many cool people. Feel free to reach out to me either through the Penn Career Services Twitter or my own Twitter. I'll put it in the show notes. And if you're a Penn student or alum and you'd like to make an appointment to talk to me, just reach out over email. I'm always happy to talk. So it was great. You know, we will probably touch on some of these subjects again in more depth. You and I usually do sort of a new media careers episode at some point during the year. So I'm sure some of the stuff we didn't even talk about any of the podcasting stuff I learned. So
yeah, for the future. And even when you said streaming earlier, I mean, obviously I should have thought Netflix at first, but I was thinking like live streaming.
Oh, no. Well, yeah,
we're another area. I mean, it's more live performance. That's
a whole other thing. No, I was talking about Netflix and Hulu and Paramount.
I was with you, but my initial knee jerk was like, oh, but then I caught on.
Yeah. You're so ahead of the game, Natty. All right. Well, it's been my pleasure talking about this, and I will see you all next time on CS Radio.
This podcast is a presentation of University of Pennsylvania Career Services, Division of Penn University Life. It was created by J. Michael DeAngelis and A. Mulan Kirshner and produced and hosted by J. Michael DeAngelis and Natty Leach. It is mixed and edited by Sadie Kyler. If you like this episode, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Penn Career Serve. Thanks for listening.